Research on drugs, drug use, and drug treatment is so valuable. Without research, how can we know what drugs do to something as small as the molecules in our brains, or to something as large as the society we live in? But research alone is not enough to truly understand. We need to add the ingredient of human experience. At Drug Talk, we talk with people who use drugs, healthcare professionals and researchers, and we explore what it's like to use drugs, recover from drug use, and treat drug-related disorders. So let's listen, let's learn, and let's talk about drugs. Hey, before we start the podcast, I just wanted to let you know that you'll hear us mention some medications by name. And if it sounds like we're supportive of these medications, it's because we've read the signs about them. And we've talked to people who have benefited from taking them. It's not because we get any funding from companies who develop or sell these medications. Okay, just wanted to be clear about that. Let's get to the podcast. Here we go. Welcome to Drug Talk. I'm your host, Michelle Peavy, psychologist and research scientist at the University of Washington's Addictions, Drug, and Alcohol Institute, or ADAI. Today, I'm here with Paul Berry, licensed clinical social worker and clinical trainer at the University of Washington's Ames Center. So to be a clinical trainer, you need to have worked as a clinician, which Paul has done for many years, including settings like Ballard High School at the Teen Health Center, Carolyn Downs Family Medical Center, and Children's Hospital, just to name a few. Prior to this clinical work, his social work career was centered in agency management, program development, and legislative advocacy supporting underserved families and unhoused and at-risk youth. The other relevant work Paul is doing right now is the yeoman's work of getting opioid use disorder treatment integrated into community health and primary care settings. Welcome, Paul. As always, it is so great to see you and to talk with you.
Hi, Michelle. So nice to see you too. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so you and I today will be talking about adolescence and opioid use disorder. And my thought is that our discussion today would be a companion of sorts to an info brief that I co-wrote with Dr. Caleb Banta-Green, also here at ADAI. And you can find the info brief on the ADAI website under publications, and it's called Understanding and Supporting Adolescents with an Opioid Use Disorder. So I thought an accompanying discussion with you, Paul, would kind of bring the info brief to life. And one of the reasons that I wanted to talk with you specifically is because in your career, you have actually chosen to work with adolescents, and you have served particularly vulnerable youth, unhoused, underserved. And so my first question to you is, what is special about adolescents?
Huh. Yeah, you know, it was the most fun part of my career, working with young people. I loved working with young people. I often got this reaction like, huh, you actually choose to do that? I mean, maybe it's a little bit easier when you don't have teenagers in the home yourself, but it's just such an exciting part of life. You know, adolescents are so full of potential and so full of energy and excitement. And at the same time, they're kind of standing on kind of slightly unstable ground because they don't really know who they are outside the reference to their families of origin. They're kind of trying to figure out who they're meant to be in the world. They're trying to figure out what their destiny is and where they're going. And, you know, so they have this just mess of things going on with them. And they often have this kind of admirable kind of sense of bravado that, you know, I'm great, I'm fine, no, it's great, like everything's great. And then, you know, when you get to know young people well, you know, there's a lot going on underneath. And some of the things that adults find so difficult about teens, I just found very charming. I mean, they're brave, you know, they're trying to get their life going, trying to understand who they are in this very, very complex and difficult world. And for some of the young people, a lot of the young people I worked with, you know, society's failed them. And they are trying to make it in the world when they haven't had the supports they really needed to be successful. Mm-hmm. So I just saw adolescence as just this font of potential. And it was such a privilege to work with them because I felt I could really have a profound influence at this stage in their life, mm-hmm. because some of them are really teetering between, you know, a good path and a path that would lead to tragedy.
You said a couple things there. And one thing that stuck out with me is society failed some of them. Say more about that.
Well, I mean, you know, you just have to read the news today about the level of anxiety and depression in young people about just the future of the climate, you know, the future of the world writ large. But I worked with a lot of homeless youth, and many, if not most of the homeless youth I worked with were refugees from the foster care system. You know, they'd been removed by the state from their families of origin, which were often traumatic and difficult places, but it's not like society had given them anything better and stuck them in foster homes. And then when they left these foster homes because they couldn't tolerate them, nobody was there to catch them, and they ended up on the street. Mm. So that's the kind of, so specifically with those young people, but you know, just, it's hard for young people to get ahead. Their opportunities are quite limited. Any of the pressures of modern life with, you know, obviously social media and, you know, constant kind of surveillance and constantly being on display at a time when they're very vulnerable to, you know, and sensitive to their image and the way they look at the world. It's a ton of stuff we've heaped on them.
Yeah. So in what you're saying, you know, the hardships that adolescents face today in 2021, And you also speak about adolescents as though they are really fun to work with, as you say. And you paint a picture of bravery and excitement and fun and identity finding. And I'm thinking about all of those tendencies of adolescence and those traits and sort of the adolescent and the adolescent brain. And I'm thinking about the adolescent brain sort of meeting up with opioids. And, you know, there's a couple things and images that come to mind for me to imagine when that kind of meetup occurs. But, you know, what are your thoughts about what that is like and what that looks like?
Well, it makes them tremendously vulnerable. You know, you talk about brain development. So, you know, we used to, well, people have all kinds of negative things to say about teenagers, but, you know, the fact that their prefrontal cortex is probably developing through their adolescence, it affects their ability to make good decisions and to weigh consequences about their actions. You know, it's not just that adolescents are willful. I mean, you know, their brains are not adult brains. You know, their brains are still being shaped and being formed by their experiences in the world. So, you know, it's hard for them to think about consequences. And they also have this, you know, what's known now as the optimistic bias. You know, I mean, they just kind of think everything's going to work out okay. You know, like they're not, which is part of the reason I like working with them so much, but which is often what makes them very vulnerable. You know, for example, the homeless youth I worked with, they never ever related to unhoused adults. You know, unhoused adolescents would always present it as being, oh, this is just a phase I'm going through, this is just experimentation, I'm not going to end up like those old guys on the street. But you know, most old guys on the street became homeless, lost their housing when they were young. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, it's just a fact of life that young people on the street will become old people on the street. Likewise, young people who are experimenting and partying with opioids have no conception about the danger they're putting themselves in, and that older people who have substance use disorder, have opioid use disorder, they also probably started when they were teenagers. You know, it's you know, I'm not like those people. I'm not going to end up like that guy who I've seen downtown with a syringe in his ankle. I'm just partying with my friends. But, you know, that's unfortunately how it starts. And some people, as we know, are very vulnerable very quickly to becoming, to developing a really serious opioid use disorder with very little preamble. I mean, for some people, it just takes a short period of regular usage for them to have a full-blown opioid use disorder.
It just happens before they know it.
Right, right. And, you know, they don't even associate, because I think they don't associate, say, the pills they're getting at a party or the pills that their best buddies got from a friend of his as maybe even being an opioid. You know, another issue, of course, with adolescents is their intense peer orientation. I mean, they're all about their peers and their friends. So, you know, if you're somewhere where someone's offering you something, you know, you're probably, there's a lot of pressure to do it. You know, there's a lot of pressure to do this thing that they're doing at a party. It's just a couple of pills. How difficult, how harmful could it be? They look just like the pills my mom has in her medicine cabinet. But, you know, who knows what these things are? They could be, you know, they're probably, you know, illicit opioids packaged to look like some other pharmaceutical. So it doesn't even have that kind of scary aspect that a syringe might have. It's just a pill like everybody in this country takes. So why not?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm thinking, you know, drug use itself is not new for adolescents. And opioid use actually also isn't really a new thing. We know that, I mean, I myself have worked with lots of people who started out their opioid use career as teenagers in this very fashion that you're describing. And, you know, I've worked with lots of people who started their opioid use careers as teenagers with OxyContin that they got at parties or as a prescription from their provider or from medicine cabinets. And just as you say, when you hear these stories of people who have well-developed opioid use disorders and talk about kind of the origin, their original story, there's really a theme out there that I have heard so many times, which is, you know, I was just a kid. I didn't know what I was doing when I tried OxyContin. And, you know, on the one hand, those OxyContin stories now kind of feel antiquated at this point, like we already did that. That already happened. That happened 10 and 20 years ago when teenagers were using OxyContin. And that was a really big deal, of course. And then on the other hand, here we are in 2021, and it's like deja vu. But this time, we're kind of in the same, but even maybe worse situation right now, except that instead of OxyContin, the drug du jour is fentanyl. And fentanyl in many ways is worse. Fentanyl, of course, is a very powerful opioid, and it's something that can be pressed into pills that look like less powerful prescription opioids. And a person can start taking fentanyl by popping a pill, eating it, crushing it up, snorting it. And young people are using fentanyl, as we know. And this is really the scary thing that's happening right now in 2021. So, Paul, you have the long view. You have worked with adolescents over the course of years, and you've seen trends come and go. And I'm just wondering, from your perspective, what do you make of what's happening right now with this current fentanyl trend for adolescents?
Yeah, well, as you say, you know, when I worked when I worked in the high school, that was a period when people, you know, they'd go to parties at people's houses and they'd check the medicine cabinets, and there'd be every single middle-class family seem to have like OxyContin, 20, 30, 40 pills in the medicine cabinet. So that's where it all started. I think the issue is now is just, I mean, from what I understand, pills are so widespread and easily available. I mean, and they're so cheap and they're just everywhere. And I mean, you know, fentanyl is so easy to transport, and these pills are apparently so easy to make, and they do look pharmaceutical. And, you know, people in this country are trained kind of to trust pills, that a pill is less dangerous than an injection. I mean, we heard so much, you know, about HIV and other blood-borne illnesses that were transmitted by syringe use. That's put a kind of a real strong stigma, I think, against injection. And somehow young people just feel like pills are not as dangerous, because they see, you know, in this country, everybody takes pills. They see everybody taking pills. Everybody in their family takes pills. People take pills. It's no big deal. And the conception that this one pill could actually kill you is such a hard concept for anybody to retain, right? But for a young person who feels somewhat invulnerable, you know, most people who have an opioid use disorder don't feel like overdose is going to be a thing that's going to happen to them. So how much more is that true for adolescents who have difficulty grasping future consequences and probably have, may have nobody they know who's overdosed or never seen an overdose? But the variability of strength of these pills is what makes them so dangerous. You know, like one pill could have 20 times the fentanyl of the pill next to it, and that's more than enough to kill you. Fentanyl is a very, very dangerous drug, which I believe older folks who use opioids, you know, that it has some attraction to them. Some people like the feeling, but they're aware of the dangers. It seems to me that young people, because it's so commonplace, you know, how could something so commonplace be so dangerous? And when there are all these, you know, they know about all these past scares about drug intent, about drugs, you know, like reefer madness and all that stuff in the past. So why should they believe that this thing is that dangerous when they see their friends doing it? And, you know, Harry did it at the party last week, so why not do it tonight?
Mm-hmm. So part of the real danger here is this, like the variability, as you say, you don't quite know what you're getting. And, you know, as you're talking about kind of adolescence, I'm thinking, you know, we can hardly blame them for wanting to try things out and for trusting maybe whoever they got the pill from. For, I mean, these are sort of young people that have not been hardened by the world yet, have not become cynical. And here they are open. And that's the very thing that is so, sounds like it's so dangerous.
Right, because, you know, I mean, it's a strange thing to say, maybe, but, you know, experimentation is part of adolescence, and they're trying to discover who they are by experimenting with different looks and different clicks and different music especially. So, you know, it's not dysfunctional or weird that they would want to experiment with their emotional state by taking drugs, unfortunately, you know. But, I mean, it's not unexpected that that's a way that young people would experiment. And, you know, it's one thing to experiment with some marijuana. It's a different thing to experiment with something that could potentially kill you very easily.
This is the difference right now, this sort of trend of fentanyl and its strength and its danger. This is what is kind of sticks out about this trend in 2021.
Yeah, and I mean, I've heard it's fairly commonplace. I mean, I've heard about it being used in the bathrooms of local high schools. I mean, you know, it's not just even at the party on Saturday night. I mean, it's people have them in schools to deal. You know, it's hard to appreciate how very widely available it is.
Well, this feels really scary and frightening, and I don't want to end there, because I don't want to end on hopelessness, and I want to turn our conversation to something a little bit more hopeful, which isn't to put a bow on what is an incredibly scary situation, but I do want to talk about treatment, because we have treatments, and this is a real place of hope. And I'm a treatment person. I'm really interested in all sorts of treatment stuff. So I have a lot to say about this. So I'm going to say a few things about treatment. And Paul, you and I both know that there are very efficacious treatments for opioid use disorder. And when I say efficacious, I mean research says that it works. And for adults, the treatments that work for opioid use disorder are the medications methadone, buprenorphine, and naltrexone. So adolescents are not wildly different than adults in terms of response to medications for opioid use disorder. That said, there are some clinical and empirical, that is research, reasons why buprenorphine may be the best bet for adolescents. And actually the info brief really outlines some of that in more detail. But bottom line, there are effective treatments for adolescents with opioid use disorder, and they are medications. And which isn't to say, and I would like to say this, that counseling and psychotherapy and other services are unimportant. So Paul and I, you and I are both trained as therapists. I love therapy. Therapy and other services are great. But medications are really the slam dunk in terms of getting adolescents to reduce opioid use and therefore die less often from opioid poisoning. So when I was writing up this info brief, I took a look at all the literature and all the research, and I tried to synthesize it and put it all together. And the research is really unequivocal about the use of medications for adolescents with opioid use disorder. That is, it's very much recommended and suggested. And also, what I found in the literature is that these same medications are absolutely way underutilized for adolescents, way underprescribed, way underused. And this is despite these sort of strong recommendations by clinical scientists. So what do clinical scientists know? Well, when I say clinical scientists, and I want to define this, I'm talking about people who are clinicians, doctors, prescribers, people who see adolescents in their practices, in their offices every single day. And they also are involved in research, studying what treatments work for whom. And it's these people who both know the science and the practice that are making these recommendations. And I was really compelled by two of these clinical scientists, specifically Drs. George Woody and Mark Fishman. And they make an especially impassioned plea to providers in a 2020 editorial in the Journal of Adolescent Health, which is entitled, this is the title, Medication Treatment for Opioid Addicted Youth. What are we waiting for? So this is an editorial. It's a strong directive to providers out there to provide medication treatment for adolescents with opioid use disorder. So Paul, you and I have worked with people who are reluctant about medications to treat opioid use disorder. This has softened over the years, but it really seems that when it comes to adolescents, people are maybe even more squirrely, more reluctant about treating adolescents with medications for opioid use disorder. So you right now, you're working in primary care settings. You're trying to get this care integrated into these settings. And presumably you're working with primary care settings that also treat adolescents with opioid use disorder. So answer me this: medication treatment for opioid addicted youth, what are we waiting for?
It's a tragedy. I mean, the lack of access is an absolute tragedy. You know, you have to relate it back to stigma at large, right? I mean, there's just so much stigma against folks who have opioid use disorder, but it's even stronger in terms of providing treatment for young people. I mean, people just can't get their heads around the fact that this lovely 17-year-old, you know, is already down this hateful path. I mean, I think that's part of it. I mean, like, you know, pediatricians didn't sign up to work with this kind of thing. You know, like pediatricians in particular, you know, are interested in children and interested in childhood. And this is such a kind of nightmarish shadow being cast from the adult world into the world of young people that I think it's just hard for people to get their heads around. You know, it's worse for adolescents, but you know, it's not great for anybody. You know, only 10% of primary care physicians in the country are waivered to provide buprenorphine. And 50% of those who are prescribing to five or fewer patients. I mean, these are you know, this is a very small part of their practice. And you know, it's not surprising that primary care physicians are called on to do everything, right? So whether they're family practice physicians, internists, or pediatricians, I mean, they're called on to do everything. They need to know everything about the lifespan or diseases of all stages of life if they're generalists. You know, a friend of mine described it as such an onerous position because you need to know a little bit about everything. And, you know, you see same. This is a tiny bit different. And if they miss that tiny bit different, that might have a huge impact on their patient. The job is to catch something early and provide a referral so the person gets treatment so it doesn't get worse. So the idea of treating opioid use disorder in primary care is a different kind of medicine to be engaged in. And I think people are just so, physicians, well, providers are so concerned about doing harm, you know, the Hippocratic oath, first do no harm, that can kind of, I don't know, make them reluctant to be proactive in dealing with a problem that's right there in front of them. It's hard for people to conceptualize of a young person as being addicted, as having a full-blown use disorder. And even though buprenorphine is a fantastic medication, and, you know, all, as you said already, all of the research points to its effectiveness, it's tremendously well-tolerated. People who take it like it, if only antidepressants were like that or other psychiatric medications. So it's a great medication that's fantastically effective for all people. And there's just this idea, well, I don't want to get this kid thing. I don't want to get this kid onto this medication. They might have to take their whole lifetime. I mean, that's a fallacy. You know, it's unlikely that somebody with a short course of an opioid use disorder is going to be on a medication for their whole lifetime. But, you know, being on this medication now and taking them out of a street scene where they could get fentanyl that would kill them tomorrow is an enormous intervention. So this idea, well, I don't want to give them this because it might cause them some harm, like versus like, well, they could go out tomorrow and buy fentanyl that could kill them. Like, you know, the 17-year-old probably is going to have trouble finding it. I mean, it's just this fear that they're going to do something which is going to ruin this kid's life. And they're not balancing that with, well, intervening when this person is 17, 18, or 19, like you could interrupt a trajectory which is going to be tragic. You know, this 17-year-old, if they continue on this course with an opioid use disorder, their lives are going to be a nightmare. I mean, at least it's going to be, disruption of family, disruption of relationships, probably involvement with the criminal legal system, probably jail, maybe prison, and maybe death. I mean, you know, it's if we can intervene early, we can change that kid's trajectory. You know, this kid that's fallen into this because of their vulnerability and their normal adolescent experimentation, perhaps, we can help them not end up like, you know, in a lifetime of misery. But it takes some bravery on the part of the providers.
That's interesting. It takes bravery. We're calling people to be brave in this situation because kind of what you're describing, there's this fork in the road and, right. You know, there's this pathway that we know to be helpful. And let's take that pathway right now. The other thing that you said is almost like we have this fantasy about what this young person's life should be like or could be like. And that's very inconsistent with someone who's kind of taking this hardcore medication for an opioid use disorder. And we kind of engage that fantasy, but here we are, you know, there's a fork in the road, there's an opportunity to intervene. And I think the other thing that you said was that people get really stuck on this rest of your life clause.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it just seems like, you know, no one is talking about the rest of anybody's life. I mean, it strikes me that adolescence, you know, the term rest of my life is not even really in their consciousness. You know, they're not even thinking about rest of life at all. They're thinking about, you know, maybe tonight and maybe tomorrow. The other thing I'll say about what the research indicates is that treatment retention among young people is some of the worst. We have a hard time keeping people engaged in treatment as it is. So nobody's even talking about rest of your life. Like, let's talk about 6 months. That might be a good place to start. And we're not even really kind of having our eyes on the horizon of rest of anybody's life.
You know, these as we've already talked about, these are young people who whose brains are developing. So hopefully, you know, the medication can take them through this time of vulnerability and they'll get their lives back on track and they'll get, you know, back in school and they'll get their lives moving forward. And when the opioid use disorder is under control, they can just carry on with their lives. But they'll have been reset from having this, you know, possible tragic trajectory back to kind of like a normal developmental trajectory and being able to gain the things that young people need to gain, you know, when they're adolescents, like schooling and relationship building and you know, growing into healthy adults. I mean, it gives them that opportunity, whereas sending them off somewhere for treatment or like, you know, sending them just to like an intensive outpatient somewhere which isn't using medication may not work. Those things don't work. And, you know, it doesn't surprise me that treatment retention is so poor. I mean, you know, young people have a lot of stuff going on, a lot of distractions. I mean, it's, you know, I don't think we should blame the patients for their lack of retention. We should look at what kind of services we're providing. You know, when I worked at the youth clinic, we were very focused on providing an environment that was youth-centric. You know, we adapted the care to meet the youth. We didn't expect the youth to adapt themselves to meet us, you know.
And what does that look like? What does that mean?
Well, you know, medical systems are super rigid and, you know, for many, like, you know, cost issues and revenue issues, you know, like there's 15-minute visits, you can't come late, you know, you have to show up at this time. Like if you come late, the doctor won't see you. We adjusted our hours. We had drop-in a separate time for youth. So the waiting room looked like a youth space. So young people felt comfortable there. It was drop-in. It was in the evening when they're available. We had vans come from youth service providers to drop people off. Like I did street outreach, so I met the youth on the street. So you know, you adapt your services to meet them. You shouldn't expect them to change themselves to meet you, especially when we're talking about children. I mean, like, you know, so in fact, you know, a pediatrician's office is probably one of the best places to serve young people with this disease, because it's a place they might have been going to for years and years and years, and they might know the providers there, and they might know the people that feel comfortable there, rather than sending them to a treatment center, which is, you know, more adult focused, and where they have to kind of fit in with the adult scenario of treatment there. I mean, why not just provide treatment to places where youth feel comfortable already? Whether that's a pediatrician's office, a family medicine clinic, or, you know, some other kind of low barrier setting like a youth center or something. This is simple medication. This is great medication. It's easy and safe to prescribe. It doesn't need a particularly evolved setting in order to provide it.
One other thing I want to go back to when we were talking about like the trajectory and interrupting that trajectory. And I was hearkening to this conversation I had with a child psychologist friend of mine. And she said, you know, I like to work with kids because you actually have a chance at making a change. It's sort of this idea that adults are already set in their ways. Like there's only so much you can do with adults, but with kids, you can really, really have it. Like you can, they're, you know, their brains are plastic, they're malleable, and they can shift. You've got some, as a clinician, she was saying, making the point that it's really sort of validating to work with young people who can really, you can watch really make changes in that way.
Yeah, I mean, they change quickly anyway because of their development, you know, but it's fascinating. I mean, you can really be influential. I mean, and what could be more influential than this, you know, which is a life-saving intervention that could completely reset this young people's life? I mean, that's why it's so heartbreaking that treatment is so little available.
Yeah. Well, Paul, what have we've not talked about a lot because this is kind of a short conversation, but what else do you have to say about this? What would you want people to know?
I mean, just the things, just to sum up the things we said already. I mean, this is, you know, this is a serious disease. Young people are very vulnerable at this moment in time in our culture to developing this disease. And also, miraculously, we have this amazing medication to treat this disease. This is, you know, the only approved medication for people aged 16 to 18. And it's the most effective medication for people over 18. I mean, we just have to work to get more providers engaged in this kind of care and to get more families. I mean, families too need to understand that this is the way to go. You know, I mean, families, not just providers, are reluctant to think about this kind of intervention with a kid, but families too find this difficult to contemplate. You know, he can't be that bad. You know, little Mary can't be that bad, surely, but they need to get on a maintenance medication. Surely we can send her away for 3 weeks and she'll be fine. But, you know, that's not the reality. We need to help these folks, these young people, in a way that's, you know, science-based and it's shown to be very effective, and to help them get the lives they deserve.
So well said. And I really appreciate you bringing up families. It's a real hole in this discussion that we didn't have all that much time, but I'm so glad you mentioned the importance of families. Possibly something to talk about in the future. And so we'll end here. And I just so appreciate all your thoughts, all your wisdom. Thank you so much for talking with me about this. So for anybody listening out there, let us know your thoughts, what we missed, which, as mentioned, was probably a lot because this is a short conversation, but we'd love your feedback. We'd love to hear from you, and you can get in touch the old-fashioned way. Send me an email at mipeavy@uw.edu. And we hope you'll join us next time. And in the meantime, let's keep listening to and learning from the best teachers and researchers we have in this field, which is the people themselves, people who use drugs and people who identify as in recovery. And we really appreciate that partnership in the work that we do. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Michelle. I enjoyed talking to you today.